You're listening to Lost and Rewound on Radio Free Brooklyn. Time to get embarrassed with us.
Greetings. Welcome again to another edition of Lost and Rewound. My name is Alon. Unfortunately, Jimmy has fallen ill this week, so he will not be here, and we wish him a speedy recovery. I miss him already. Hoffman, you're breaking my heart. In the meantime, we look forward to a great show regardless, and we're sorry that he will not be here, but I am excited for the contents of what this show will have. So, without further ado, let us get started. Is a writer, comedian, and New Hampshire native. Patrick J. Riley is a Brooklyn-based stand-up comic and comic book connoisseur, currently heading up Carmine Street Comics in the West Village. Together, these two host their own podcast entitled We Wrote a Musical, and they are here this week to talk about just what that musical is, as well as share some earlier creative projects from their past. Welcome, Patrick and Kevin.
Hey. Hello.
How did you guys meet?
We met at the Creek in the Cave.
Yeah. Is that where we met?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't remember where we first met. I just remember during Hurricane Sandy when everybody had like a week off from doing mics because you couldn't get anywhere in the city. Everything was shut down.
Yeah.
And I had found out that a bunch of comics lived in my neighborhood. So I just like put a thing on Facebook like, hey, if I put a mic on in my bedroom, would people come over and do a mic? And like 30 comics were like, oh my God, that'd be great. I haven't done comedy in 5 days. And then a bunch of people that I knew showed up, and then this kid who I met at a mic apparently once before just showed up with a bottle of wine, drank it immediately.
I was very good friends with Will Carey.
Okay.
And he invited me.
Okay.
And
that makes sense. And you walked from Sunset Park, Brooklyn to Woodside, Queens.
I know you didn't.
I get super cagey and I don't like being alone for very long. And Sandy was awful just because you were so trapped.
Yeah.
And also people lost their houses and died. But for me, I was trapped and alone. So like I walked from Sunset Park to Woodside. I stopped at Atlantic. I saw Wreck-It Ralph by myself. And then I took a bus to Queens. And then from Queensboro Plaza, I walked to his apartment at Woodside. And
I walked from Woodside to Bay Ridge because my now fiance, then girlfriend lived there. So I just walked after Hurricane Sandy when everything was shut down. I didn't have work. I just started a new job and was not at a phase where they had given me a computer that I could take home. So I just had a week vacation that I was getting paid for, which was great.
I love this.
I wrote a web series a couple years ago called The Worst Landlord. And it was me and Will Carey, who was my roommate. And Lisa, my fiance, is a video production person. And she was like, you should write a web series that I can film and then we can work on it together. And all the ideas I had were really out there. And she's like, do something we can just shoot in the apartment that's just like two guys in an apartment. And so I did a whole thing where Will lived in an apartment and I was his weird landlord. And then each one was just this short 2-minute goofy sketch. And I had the idea that I would bring in other comedian friends to play weird parts. And everybody bailed last minute. And then Pat showed up to do one. And then I just made his character a recurring character for 37 episodes of it. Phil Deadman. He was a dead guy who lived under the sink.
Yeah.
And then he becomes a bigger character.
And then I slowly become like
the villain.
The villain of the piece. It was a lot of fun. It was great.
I also wrote a prequel that we never did anything with.
Yeah.
It was a Better Call Saul for Phil Deadman.
My goodness. Yeah. Was there something specifically about your landlord that just made you say, I cannot take this anymore, I am writing something about this?
It was very much based on every building super I've ever had. I had one guy who, apparently this is not normal, but it happens a good amount of time, but it's not like a norm where the super would have keys to all the apartments and would just let himself in whenever. It's like, it's not illegal, but it's also like, hey.
Common courtesy. You
know? Right. So like, I'd be home sometimes and he would just come in and be like, oh, hey, I had to take a look at your sink. Why didn't you just say, hey, I'm going to be in your apartment?
Yeah.
Things like that. Or, you know, when things break and you can't get a hold of anybody to actually fix it. And big things. Like after Hurricane Irene, I lived on the top floor. So Hurricane Irene wasn't a big deal, but we got a lot of rain and it went through my ceiling. And I saw like a little spot and I was like, hey, I think there's a leak on the roof. Oh, okay, it'll be fine. And then the leak turns into a crack. And over the course of a week, it just got longer and longer. I was like, hey, I'm sending him pictures with my crappy flip phone at the time. And I'm like, hey, this is getting worse. And then I woke up when a giant piece of plaster fell out of the ceiling onto my bed.
No.
And then the guy was like, all right, I'll come by and fix it. And then 2 weeks later, he kept his word and came and fixed it.
Oh, my God. So
for 2 weeks, I just had a hole in my roof.
Cool.
Yep.
What about you, Patrick? Something just as egregious as that?
No, I've always lived with family or some sort. My grandfather owns an apartment building in Sunset. So I do have terrible stories, but they're also like, he's my grandfather. So you got to love him. He's a terrible, terrible, super landlord. Because it's this one big apartment building. It's just all my cousins and my brothers and I. We all just live in. Basically, my grandfather, he's had tenants in the past. But they all leave because he would do stuff like that where he would just walk into their apartment and he would kind of meddle with their lives because he has nothing else to do. He's just an old, weird Puerto Rican retired guy who just doesn't like speaking English and doesn't like you. And that's how he kind of operates as a person. So after a while, he just stopped renting to other people and just rented to family. And I've lived in 3 of the apartments in every single floor. Each apartment just got visibly worse. Now I live in what could be considered a shack. Because I decided that I don't want to have to split a room or an apartment with my brothers or cousins anymore. So I got the smallest room and I'm crowded by books everywhere. So anytime my grandfather comes in, I know he's in my apartment. If I get a text like, you got too many books, I'm going to start giving these away. I'm like, no, you can't because those are my things. I said, like, if you give mine away, I have keys to your apartment. I'll start giving your stuff away. And I called him on his bluff one time. I had some old records. And it's not even like cool records. They're all just old Broadway vinyls that I found. And he gave them to my cousin. He lives in like Staten Island. My cousin sent me a text of like, hey, Juan just gave me some Broadway vinyls. Because I don't think he understands how music works, that people have different tastes. Are these yours? And I'm like, yeah, no one has the Wiz or the vinyl to 9 other than me.
I have the Wiz.
You have the Wiz. Yeah. So I found out he went through, and I just took his TV, and then I sold it on Craigslist. And then I gave him the money, and I went, hey, I sold your TV. And he goes, why did you do that? I'm like, did you give away my records? He goes, you called your bluff. Good job. Good. Proud of you. I raised a good one if you sold my TV on Craigslist.
Did you listen to a lot of musical recordings growing up? Or was
it's all I listen to.
It's all you listen to?
Yeah, I don't like regular music. I like maybe like 10 bands, and it's everything else is just musical theater.
When was the first time you saw a musical?
Live? I think I was 7. I saw Mark Anthony and Paul Simon's The Cape Man. It ran for 47 performances. It was critically panned. It was not very good. I don't remember anything from it other than my grandmother being so excited to see Mark Anthony on stage. And I think it was his only time ever being on Broadway.
Being that Patrick grew up in New York and got a chance to see Broadway shows a little earlier on, Kevin, did you get a chance to visit New York? Or was there an impression that you had had about Broadway musicals before you moved here officially?
Not really. I visited New York once before I moved here. I moved here after college and I was like 22, 23.
Sure.
And the only time I'd visited New York City was when I was 16 on a school trip. And I saw Mamma Mia on stage, and I hated it.
Hated it.
Because it's a lot of ABBA.
It's awful. And it's a terrible show.
And the story
is
also...
too much ABBA.
It's really dumb. So I'd seen that. I liked Wiz, the movie, and Little Shop of Horrors, the movie. So I knew more, like, movie musicals and, like, the things our high school would do. But the first musical I saw where I was like, oh, this is really fun. Because, like, we did Annie Get Your Gun and Anything Goes and all those high school staples. Every 2 months, someone would be doing Godspell. There's one guy that's still in New Hampshire, and he started his own theater company. And basically, he'll just do Godspell at high schools every year. Like, that's his bread and butter, is doing Godspell over and over and over again.
Well, you got to give it up to him because he's clearly committed to making the best production he could absolutely make, no matter what it takes, however long it takes.
Right. But then in college, a friend of mine got the lead part in Bat Boy, the musical, based on the Weekly World News tabloid story. And it's fantastic. It's just a whole story about these kids find the Bat Boy in a cave, and then he just eats everybody's cows and is actually, well, that there's like a twist at the end where...
Spoiler.
Yeah, sorry. He's a vampire child and
Larry
everybody...
O'Keefe.
Yeah, who also did Legally Blonde, the musical.
And Heather's, the musical, which is incredible. Yeah. Legally Blonde's pretty great.
Blonde is great.
I've been singing Legally Blonde. I woke up for some reason singing Legally Blonde today. Yeah. And then I was just like, all right, I'll listen to it. I listened to it. I'm like, oh, Legally Blonde's so good.
But that was like the first time where I was like, oh, musicals don't have to be these old-timey, you know. Because I do like Irving Berlin's Tin Pan Alley type songs, but it does feel very dated. So like
Yeah. Even Hello Dolly. I was listening to Hello Dolly the other day. Dated. And it's so dated. And it's like from 19...
The main song from that is a guy saying like, whoa, I need a woman to cook and clean for me. And that was like a love song back then. Like, it's super dated. But Bat Boy was one where it was like a rock musical. And I was like, oh, this is like really out there and like kind of new. And even Rent is a rock musical, but it still plays into so many like classic musical tropes with a lot of things. But this was one where it's like, fuck Broadway. Like, we're just going to make this crazy thing. And that was my kind of like, we have our show now that we're working on it. Anytime we do any of the classic Broadway tropes, we immediately undercut it by making fun of that trope.
It's like one of the things I'm super proud of with the show is how we play into every single trope and then point out and go like, that's stupid as shit, right? No one falls in love in a day. You know what I mean?
It's funny because when David Piccolomini was on the
show. Pickles.
Probably one of our more excitable guests.
He's an excitable boy.
Was
he talking shit?
Oh, no.
Okay, cool.
Well, what happened was one of the clips that he had to share was his production of the Lewis and Clark musical he did when he was...
Oh, the fourth grade one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hysterical.
Great. I looked up clips from it because when we were writing it, I was like, let me make sure nobody's done a Lewis and Clark musical. And the only thing I could find was the fourth grade version where I actually put in a line that was using that, like a bunch of kids. Like, Lewis and Clark... Clark and Lewis.
We put it in where now it's Lewis and Clark.
Clark and Lewis.
Actually, that doesn't sound right. We're Lewis and Clark. Yeah.
The Great Frontier. When did this come about? How did you decide you were going to make it? And where do you stand now with the project? You have a podcast about it, obviously.
We have a podcast called We Wrote a Musical because we wrote a musical.
Yeah.
Couldn't be more meta.
Now it's actually about making the musical again. We did a reading of it in October last year. All right. Let's start at the beginning.
A
very good place to start.
We'll start with the seed of an idea, and then...
We'll start at the scene.
Halloween show.
But 2 years ago now? Three years ago? 2 years ago, we did this Halloween show that I put together with Kathy Humes, and it was Little Shop of Horrors and Rocky Horror Picture Show done with karaoke tracks, and then we improvised the scenes in between the songs.
Because the whole thing is, like, you need to license a play if you're going to perform it, but improv is legal,
and karaoke is legal. So,
we just did an improvised karaoke version of Rocky Horror and Little Shop.
Brilliant.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Kevin played Brad and Seymour, and I played Riff Raff, Rocky, and the dentist. It was so amazing. We had a packed out house.
Oh, my God.
People fucking went nuts, and we put a lot of work into it.
We started prepping for it in, like, June of that year for a Halloween night show.
We started getting ready, casting everyone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We had the venue set. We were like, great, we're going to do it. And then in September, we started going like, all right, everyone learn your words. And then all of October, we just spent getting ready for it.
Yeah.
It just went so well. And then a week afterwards, Kevin and I were just so depressed.
I love Little Shop so much. And, like, we had so many fun bits in it where, like...
It was great.
Tied in the American Psycho musical where we just play, like, Hip to Be Square. And, like, I chop up Patrick for ruining my scene. They, like, ruin the big love song number and...
Yeah, we ruin Suddenly Seymour. Yeah.
And then I get mad and it turns into American Psycho and I, like, do the monologue. We had so much fun doing it and then we were super depressed after... And even, like, going back to just doing stand-up, it was like, I feel nothing from this. Like, we did this musical thing.
And a friend of ours was putting together a Christmas Carol.
Oh, yeah.
But if it was written by David Mamet. And I played, what's his name?
Cratchit?
Bob Cratchit.
Yeah. I was the original Scrooge, but then I bailed.
He bobbed out. It just didn't have the same feel as the musical.
Andy kept changing the script every day.
Every day.
Who is this?
I don't want to name names because I didn't have fun working on it.
Fair enough.
I had fun. It was Sam C. wrote it.
Okay.
He's been on the show before as well.
Yeah. He just got in his head about it and he kept writing the script. At the end of the day, I thought it was very good. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. But
I'm not a really good actor. And when you keep changing the script, I couldn't study it. And I was like, just for the good of this show, I can't do it.
I think he was a great director, though. He was a lot of fun to work with as director. But it just didn't have the same feel as working on that musical. And that musical was so incredible.
So we were
sitting in a bar.
After rehearsing the Mammoth thing,
him and I were sitting in a bar. We're like, we need to get that high again. And we just like, you know what?
Let's write a musical.
And we sat in the bar and we just went through a list because we were like,
we literally pulled out a notebook.
We pulled
right
a notebook and we're like, here's a list of two-man things that we can do.
Yeah.
And
we wanted it to be something. Ooh, what was the name of that bar? It's on Bleecker Street. It's right up the Bleecker.
It has a clown on it. the clown's on the door.
I'm already there.
Yeah.
I don't remember the name of it. It's right down the block from the Lynn Redgrave Theater.
Okay.
There's a monument to me and Patrick inside for where we conceived the idea. There's like a statue.
Kind of like how the White Horse Tavern has like this is where Hemingway sat.
Yes.
It's like a indented seat. And they're like, there's Patrick's seat.
My scent is still on the stool.
Yeah. We just started coming up with ideas that we could do where, like, we could be the lead people. And we just, because we've done a bunch of sketch stuff together and weird duo bits. It's like, well, let's do something.
You've worked together, so this is something that was familiar to you. And it is just a larger scale.
Much larger scale. We also were very naive about how large the scale was, which was probably the greatest asset.
We were like, we could just write the
musical. We could just write a musical.
And we figured the easiest thing to do is to take a historical event.
Yeah.
Because then we wouldn't have to worry about
rights.
But thinking up a rights. As much as thinking about like having to come up with a beginning, middle, end, because it would be historically done for us.
Yeah. So we picked Lewis and Clark.
Yeah.
We landed on Lewis and Clark because it's two guys. Mm-hmm. We can be Lewis and Clark, and it's got a clear like you know commission for the expedition. The actual expedition would be the middle, and then the end is obviously they get to Pacific Ocean.
Exactly.
So that was why we picked it, and then we just started thinking, what if we just ignore all the historical accuracy so that we don't even have to give a shit about what actually happened to Lewis and Clark? Like, what if Thomas Jefferson's the bad guy because he's a lazy president? And like, we just started coming up with all these like weird things. And then we got really excited about it. This was
November.
And then December 5th of, what was that, 2015? That was when you came over and like, I wrote one of the songs.
Yeah.
And I was like, great. I wrote 17 pages of script. And then we just started reading it.
He had started outlining the first act.
Yeah. And I had like a really clear idea of like, why is Jefferson the bad guy? And I like had a really good idea.
And then I wrote the love song between Sacagawea and Lewis.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is what the love song should be. And it's a parody of like Rodgers and Hammerstein, where they're all like, oh, I love you so much, but I can't say it. Where this one is.
An ordinary couple.
Yeah.
All that we should.
Exactly. It was that or like, if I loved you. I think it's so funny because it's just so, I love Oscar and Hammerstein, but it's just so like, just get fucking on with it. We know it's going to happen. So in this version, it's Lewis is just so awkward around women that he can't say I love you because he's going to throw up in his mouth. And that's the whole song is discovering you, which is him like about to say I love you, and then him like having a nervous breakdown every single time.
That was 2015. So 2016. Yeah.
2016
we just worked on the script.
I was like, we're going to set deadlines for ourselves. All right, it's December, we have the holidays, blah blah blah. So by the end of January, let's try to have a first draft.
Yeah, January 25th was the exact day. We're like, by January 25th, if we don't have a draft, I think we just call it. And then
I don't think we said that. I think it was just like, well, as long as we have a first draft then, and then the goal will be every month we do a new rewrite, and then once we feel it's good, we'll start staging it and everything.
Yeah.
And then we wrote it all in the month of December, a month ahead of schedule, because we were just manically writing. I wrote the opening song, it's called The Something Somethings, where we set up that we don't actually know anything, and they keep saying in the 18 something somethings, and like they don't know what year it is or anything like that. Sacagawea sings it, and then there's like a backup chorus of Native Americans, and they sing about American history from the Native Americans' point of view. So it's all like genocide and like awful things that the white settlers were doing.
Yeah.
But it's like a very peppy Gladys Knight and the Pips type doo-wop number.
Yep.
But they're just singing about these awful historic events and just being
sugarcoating.
Very sugarcoated.
Yeah.
And genocide is never mentioned again, but it's just like, hey, we know, because at like the,
keep few it back things, in your mind, you know what happens.
There's just this underlaying thing, just like real American history, where like underneath you're like, well, all this stuff was actually pretty terrible, what was going on. So I wrote that in an airport on New Year's Eve when I was like flying to, I was going out to California, and my flight got 3 hours delayed, so I finished it there. And then I was like, oh, we just finished the first draft of the musical. So then for 4 months we rewrote it. We had a couple meetings with like actors that we brought into my apartment, and we did a reading in the apartment. And then I was working on the music at the same time. My goal was to finish it by June of that year, and I finished it in April, because it was just, every day I would get up, work on it a little bit, go to work, come home, work on the music a bit more, and I finished it 2 months ahead of schedule. And then
beautiful.
Yeah, and then I think we did another reading, and then we took the summer off because nobody could do it, and then we just picked a day in October that was actually the 1 year anniversary of when we did that Halloween show.
Yep.
Just
so within a year we wrote a brand new.
Yeah, and so we did it at the Creek in the Cave, and we just, you know,
it was a good reception.
We sold it out.
We sold it out.
Like, to the point that our lighting and sound person was just like, how many people are you expecting? Because we're taking tables out, adding more rows. She's like, how many people do you think are coming?
And we thought,
I was like, well, how many does the room fit? And she's like, 40? And I was like, we have 76 pre-sales. We had free tickets, but we had a pre-sale.
So you had to turn people away from the door? People were standing.
Some people left. Some people just ended up standing wherever they could to watch it. It was incredible.
It's the stuff of envy, gentlemen. It's the stuff of envy.
July 24th, 28th, and 30th, we're at the New York Theater Festival, the Summerfest.
Excellent.
So we got
That's
in.
New. That's brand new.
We found out we got in in January, and then we had to recast a few parts, and then we've been rehearsing for about a month now, and we got 2 more months until the show. So we're rehearsing it now. We have an actual director. We have a amazing piano player. We have the girl playing Sacagawea, Sarah.
So fucking
good. Oh my god, her voice is beautiful.
So incredible. The cast is great.
The cast is great. It's gonna be good. It's gonna be a full production. For the reading, even though we were in costumes, we had our scripts on stage because we only had 8 rehearsals. That was all people could give time for. But this one, it was like, we're doing it for 3 months, and if you can't do it, let us know and we recast it, whatever. And so now we're doing full character development and like really digging into the choreography and the singing and everything. And so it's like a full-on production of it.
You have a Patreon for the project setup still?
Yes, we do. We'll be starting a Kickstarter within the next week or so, yeah.
How is it having a Patreon and a Kickstarter for the two different sides of the funding, I guess?
The Patreon kind of is really like almost exclusively like we put through the musical where like we talk about in the musical, like donate to our Patreon.
Yeah.
But the Kickstarter is going to be everywhere. You're going to.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard to miss.
The Kickstarter is also like, hey, this is for we need now money because it's very expensive to put it.
Yeah.
Just rehearsal spaces alone are, you know, even though we found like a pretty decent place, it's still like $50 a pop and we're rehearsing for 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, I have this money saved up, but we need some help. I'm not too proud to beg. And there's like going to be rewards. Like if you donate, your ticket's free for the show, or, you know, we'll give you the demo CD with 7 of the songs, me and Patrick singing the songs. And you know, we have things like that and to try to make it, you know, incentivize people to throw money at us.
Yeah.
And
we also have signed copies of the script.
Yeah. The cool things like that.
I dig it.
Kevin will write you a song.
Oh yeah. I'll write you a theme song. I've written a bunch of theme songs for friends podcasts. I was like, I'll write you a 30-second theme song. Good. You can be like Shaft with your boombox and it's just like a song about you.
Like the boombox right here in the studio.
Yes.
I don't know who left that boombox, but whoever did, it's fucking pimp. People want to check out the Patreon, and just as well, they want to go take a look at the musical in its current state. Obviously, you are doing your podcast about it called We Wrote a Musical, and where do the people go to find out more information about The Great Frontier?
There's a Facebook.
Yep, the Facebook is facebook.com/Great Frontier Musical. I also have all the information on my website, which is kfcomedy.com. And there's a Great Frontier Musical page on that. It's just kfcomedy.com/Great Frontier Musical again. And that's,
if you can't find that, you can go to comicsbypatrick.com/Great Frontier, which will redirect you to Kevin's website.
Does it really?
Yeah, because I was going to do it. I'm like, it's already there. And it just redirects you to your website with all the information on it.
Yeah. But it directs you to, you know, where you can get tickets and when the show dates are and more information about the show. You can listen to the demos, everything like that.
Yeah. Great. You guys ready to get a little more lost and rewound?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man,
embarrassed a little bit?
I'm so embarrassed. I forgot what this was. And then when I walked in, I'm like, oh, this is the worst.
When we come back, we're going to find out just what the worst is. This is Lost and Rewound on Radio Free Brooklyn. As we do here every week on Lost and Rewound, we invite you to share your old audio. This is the show where, when your old audio is collecting dust, Jimmy and I knock on your door or email you being like, God damn it, we know you've got it. Come on and share it. And if you are able to be shameless in your present self, be shameless in your past self. Kevin.
Yes.
You were a part of a ska band in high school.
Oh, boy. Calling it ska would be an insult to ska, I think. I was in a straight-up ska band in college called Ska Reem Abdul Jabbar.
Ska.
And that's when I knew that I was destined to be a comedian instead of a ska musician. But
what instrument did you play?
I played the tenor saxophone.
Okay.
Were
you playing in band as early as, you know, 9 or 10?
I was 10 and I started playing clarinet. And then in high school, I started playing the saxophone because I wanted to join the jazz band.
Mm-hmm.
And then I taught myself flute senior year with some help from the girl who was the first chair flautist in high school. because I discovered Jethro Tull and thought the flute was the coolest instrument. I never knew that there were, like, levels of coolness in instruments. I thought the flute and the saxophone were just as cool as the guitar, and it turns out that's not true.
Right. This is something that our friend Matt Finch was talking about, how playing the saxophone probably not going to necessarily get you in the good graces of a band, per se.
No. But I was friends with all the people in high school that had bands, and so, like, I just liked playing music. It didn't matter where. So, like, I had friends that had their little indie rock band, and then eventually they were like, oh, come play saxophone. And I would just, like, go to their weird community center gigs where a bunch of 16-year-olds playing saxophone. One time the bass player couldn't make it, so I just learned his bass lines on saxophone. It was weird, but it worked. So this band was called Fair Fight, and they described themselves as ScaMo. This was at the...
ScaMo.
ScaMo.
Dario.
Scaramouche?
Ska and emo combined?
Yes.
This was right when... Oh, what's the band? Fall Out Boy was in there, you know.
Their prime.
Their prime. We're going. So that, I still don't like Fall Out Boy, but I could not get away from that song. And that whole wave of emo was like the big thing for 2004, 2005, 2006 high schoolers. The more important thing about Fair Fight is that they were a short-lived band that I was in high school that was featured on an episode of MTV's Made.
So how did that happen?
Well, what Made likes to do is go to high schools in the middle of nowhere, a lot in New Hampshire, actually. They were like,
why?
Because
why?
Because we're desperate to first anything.
But you could pick anywhere on the East Coast. You could go to any one state of the New England region. Why New Hampshire?
I think it might have just been that year. I think that, I mean, if I worked at Viacom and, like, wanted to be smart about it.
I'm just going to go to this area of New Hampshire with a tiny little dinky school of people with very, very white piercing dreams.
Oh, yes, yes. But if it were me, the smart thing to do would be, like, pick a state, find a bunch of schools in that state, and then knock out a whole season. So I think it might have just been our season. They happened to do, like, 3 episodes in New Hampshire, and, like, a lot of them were New England-based around then. But they picked our school, and they had auditions to see who wants to be made into something. I'd seen Made. I was very familiar with Made. I thought Made was just like every other VH1 or MTV reality show, was just dumb, and it is really dumb. So I did not even audition to be on Made. My friend Sarah Metzger, our friend, she went and said, I want to be made into a brown bear.
What?
And she's the best.
She's great. She wore like a brown bear head. She's like, well, I want like a made coach. Like, I want someone to be like, hi, I'm Smokey the Bear. I'll be your made coach.
Oh my goodness.
And basically, it's kind of sad, but what Made will do is find who's the most pathetic person that we can put on TV.
To be a talent scout in the mid-aughts, right?
Yeah. So they picked this girl, Alexa, great singing voice, percussionist in the bands. She was in chorus, I think. But, you know, she was a capable, talented musician, but she wanted to be in a rock band and just had all these anxieties and insecurities that kept her from doing that. So that was like the arc of the episode. She wants to start this rock band. She puts flyers up because she needs her band. Who's going to be in the band? And there was a poster around school that was like, bandmates needed, guitar, bass, drummer. And I was a senior. She was a junior at the time. And all I wanted was to be on MTV for 10 seconds because I thought it'd be funny. I'll show up with my saxophone and just play a bunch of nonsense. And I'll be so bad that they'll definitely put it on TV. And that was all I wanted to do. So I show up. There's cameras recording this. And I came out with my saxophone, which nobody asked for to be there. And I just started playing a bunch of random notes, no song in particular, just a lot of whip, whip, but not even like jazz, free jazz or anything.
Yeah, I saw the episode and the clip that they used is him literally playing scales.
Not even.
Like,
just
duh.
Then the best part is it cuts to the Made coach, who was this guy, Frank, who I still keep in touch with. He's really cool. He has this band, Waltham, in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Okay.
They were pretty great. They were like this very 80s anthemic arena rock type sound, but they were a lot of fun. They were really cool guys. And it cuts to him in his like leather jacket and duct taped pants and everything. And just like, kid's pretty cool.
Wow.
And so I got into the band by being terrible, which was not the intention. So I spent a good 2 or 3 months of senior year being on MTV and just being ordered around by these MTV producers. And the whole episode culminates with us at the high school battle of the bands. We got second place because we had cameras and like a room full of people that were there to see us.
Yep.
It was really weird. Basically take everything that was going on at 2005, 2006, and let's shove it all into one band. And then I had the saxophone and they were like, well, you got to throw some like Boss Tones in there. Or like,
what?
I mean, Boss Tones and like Morphine was like the other big band that they were like, oh, you got to listen to these. And this is like,
wow.
You know, Frank's like this like 40-year-old dude who's just like, no, listen to Morphine and like all these other bands I'd never heard of. Morphine's still one of my favorite bands.
Yeah, no, but it's just really funny to that. It that they're like, just follow these bands, kid. That's yeah. all it'll take.
Yeah, yeah.
You'll find your muse.
Yeah. They basically put me in because I was just this goofy, awkward kid. I do not come off looking cool at all in the episode. Jordan, the bass player, had like a crush on her. So there's like this love triangle. And this 14-year-old kid was the guitarist. My friend Joey, who's an amazing guitarist, he like went full Cobain in those 3 months. And was
oh,
just like,
I'm sure.
Oh, I hate being on this show. I hate the fame.
There's always got to be one.
Yeah. And so he like disappeared into the woods for like a week. There's like all this stuff. And then there's,
you
just,
do,
and then
you
there's
do.
Just me being like this goofy, lanky kid. I basically just look like this, but I had more hair and a higher voice and no facial hair. And I would just play the saxophone and they'd be like, okay, here's this indie rock song. Now, Kevin, play some saxophone with it. And I knew nothing about writing music at the time or like how to write. I was very bad. When we listen to it, I cringe at it because it's just me trying to force the saxophone into it as much as possible. And now that I've written the musical, it's like, oh, it's okay to have like silence. You don't need to have constant things
noise,
going on.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it was, oh, it was so bad. We only lasted a couple of months. We did the Battle of the Bands at the high school. We signed up for another Battle of the Bands later. And then after that, just everybody imploded. And it fell apart.
So we have two clips to listen to on that note. We do have the flagship song by yep. Fairfight called Teenage Calamity. And then let's play that now, and then we'll get to the Battle of the Bands
okay.
after.
Okay.
Those were the terrible. And you're going to hear me sing about a squirrel later.
Oh,
it's
my God.
Real. Oh, man.
I haven't listened to that. I know I sent this in, but I wanted to listen to it so I could have some commentary right now. But then I listened to those opening lyrics and I had to shut it off. And I was like, no, I want whatever. I need this to be real. I'm sorry that we had to listen to that.
I love it's so I started listening because there's no reason for saxophone to be in it.
No.
And I just love the idea of the, like someone like record producers. But
oh,
it's just
God.
Like someone just like, hey, who let that kid in? Get out of here. We're trying to write an emo punk song.
I wish we'd recorded more of our songs because there were other ones that they like we all wrote it together. Hey, the saxophone can fit in here.
Yeah.
And it made sense. But this one, it did not make sense at all. And it was just like, well, what can I play here? And they're like, oh, we'll just play over like, the vocals. Yeah, yeah. It's, also, it man, says it sounds. It sounds like friend like you, friend like me.
Now, now, at this time, you hadn't discovered comedy per se yet.
No, but boy, were people laughing.
And yeah, point taken. You were involved in some kind of form of songwriting. So this is sort of like a glimpse into your first days as a songwriter in some respects.
Yeah.
Do you see it the same way that I'm seeing it? It is a first foray into songwriting, or were you kind of hands-off for the most part? You just played the sax and then let everybody else?
I just played the sax. There were other songs that I had much better saxophone contributions on.
Okay.
I was in bands all through like high school and college, and like my college band was where I actually, like, I've gone back and listened to that. I was like, that's probably where I plateaued with saxophone, but it was like, okay, I'm actually like proud of some of the stuff we did in that, but
yeah.
I realized that I didn't really enjoy playing original songs. I always loved playing cover. Like, I would love to just be a dad in a cover band. I think that's my destiny, is to just be a dad in a cover band.
I can't wait for you to be like, you guys ready for some Jimmy Buffett's?
Just become my dad?
Yeah, become your dad.
Oh, boy.
I'm so excited for this weekend. We're going to spend this weekend with his parents.
Yeah, yeah, it's going to be fun.
And it's going to be great to just talk Springsteen with his mom. And
yeah.
What did they think about this?
About Fair Fight? Oh, my God. My favorite thing about it was that the maid coach, the guy from the band Waltham, he was also like, this is stupid. And I was like, yeah, this is stupid. He's like, rock and roll. Yeah. Doing a thing, even though it's stupid.
On the same page.
Making fun. But like the teachers, it was so disruptive to every class. If we were in a class, like cameras would come in to get clips of us in our natural habitat. And it was so distracting. Our music teacher hated it most of all because it would ruin rehearsals. They would stop the rehearsal. Alexa has a speech to make in front of everybody. And then he'd be like, yeah, we're rehearsing some James Swearingen marches right now. So could you please not do this? My parents thought it was a weird thing. I was a very quiet kid, so it was weird that I was doing anything in front of people. But senior year, I kind of went off the deep end with just like, I'm graduating. Let's just do all the weird stuff as possible. And so this was just like another thing. Like, yeah, Kevin's just doing this dumb, weird thing.
It's so funny.
The tragedy was like all the other people in the band were very, very talented. Jordan, the bass player, he was a guitarist mostly, so he can still play the bass. He's doing his job as the bass player, but Joey's guitar solo on that, I'm like, I forgot how insanely good he was as a 14.
That was really good.
As a 14-year-old
kid. Yeah.
I remember the.
You always have that friend who's like the guitar prodigy when you're growing up.
So good. And Becca, the drummer, she still plays occasionally with like cover bands. She lives out in the Midwest now, and she actually just became a special education teacher. And she's married. She lives out in Fargo and like has like her own life, but she still plays drums occasionally. And
sweet.
She posted a video of her. She's playing Victoria. It's a Kinks song. It's got like a long 60s stoner title, but I'm so happy she still plays because she was so good at the drums. She could play jazz. She could play rock. She was just like the kind of person that's like, we need someone to play, and she could do it. And her dad worked for the rock station, the radio station. So her whole basement was just rock memorabilia. So, like, that was my favorite part was I'm like, you have Emerson, Lake & Palmer's drum head over here and, like, a signed copy of Tommy the album and just, like, crazy rock memorabilia that I loved so much.
No big deal.
Yeah. They thought it was funny more than anything because then I didn't realize that MTV and Made were, like, big things. The episode ended. It was like, oh, we're a rerun now. And we thought it was funny. But then for, like,
We're a rerun.
For a good week, we were, until the next episode aired, we would, like, walk around Concord, New Hampshire. People would be like, hey, you're the guy from that thing. Like, people would recognize us on the street. And I'm like, oh, I understand why people like Kurt Cobain get fed up with fame. Like, this is really annoying. You think it's going to be cool because all these people saw a thing on TV, but then you realize, oh, they're going to bother you all the time. Like, this is why the teachers were equally bothered. We were also, like, 16, so we're just egomaniacs walking around. Like, we're on TV and everything like that. My parents did not like that I was sneaking out of the house to go to these band practices sometimes, a couple times sneaking back into the house at 3 in the morning. They didn't know this, but we were in, like, a warehouse in Waltham with, like, all these, like, metal bands, and they were all doing, they're doing, like, pills and drinking whiskey out of cups, and I didn't do any of that stuff.
Those hooligans.
Yeah. They didn't use any of the footage from that because everybody but me were smoking pot and drinking rum out of the bottle in the background, and I was like, no, my parents will murder me if I come back doing any of this. That's how rock and roll I was. I was like, no, I don't want to make my parents upset, which was a good call because I came home, snuck into the house, shut the door, and then turned the light on. And turned around, and my mother was sitting on my bed waiting for me in the dark. And she goes, where the fuck have you been? In hindsight, it was hilarious. But at the time, it was one of the most terrified times I've ever been.
Did they go to the Battle of the Bands to support you?
Yes, they did. They did. They were very supportive. And they're like, well, we got to see this. Then they just think it's a weird MTV phase that I went through where I was on MTV. And I remember we went out to dinner as a family once. And the table next to us was like, hey, do you go to Hopkinton High School? Do you go to this school? I feel like I know you from somewhere. And then I was like, no. And then afterwards, my dad was like, oh, they recognize you from that show. And I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Because it was really weird. They're like, I've seen you from so – you go to this school, right? Why do I know you? And then my dad was like, oh, you know him from because he was on TV. And they thought that was really funny. And it was a good like year and a half that people would recognize me and other people too, I'm sure. But I went to college a year later and people would be like, I remember you from that episode of Maid. I never talked about it in college.
Yeah.
But people would recognize me the first couple years of college from that. And every now and then it would re-air. And people be like, oh, my God, that's you, but goofier looking.
I feel like there is now this point in our society where people could be famous kind of by accident, whereas before it was a lot more premeditated and orchestrated. And then when there's the afterglow of that fame and there's this subsiding period where everyone's noticing you, people just weren't really accustomed to that back then. Whereas now I feel like everyone's accustomed to maybe the very possibility that your tweet or Instagram video or Snapchat thing has been seen.
That's a good point, because this was also the first year of YouTube being a thing.
Yeah.
It was before there were like viral video stars or anything like that. But then you fast forward like 2 years later and Donald Glover's whole sketch group, Derek Comedy, blows up. If I saw Donald Glover on the street in 2007, even though he was technically a nobody, I would be like, oh my God, I'm starstruck because I love all of your videos on YouTube. Yeah, but this was the very last year of being famous from being on an actual television station instead of here's a tweet or, you know, YouTube. There was no social media. It was still MySpace. We were on MySpace still.
We got to get to the Battle of the Bands clip.
This was right before our breakup. Because the bass player and the lead singer were dating and then not dating, it caused a big riff. So we decided to kick the bass player out. It was very emotional. He was very mad. And then we replaced him with a friend of Joey's who played bass. And then this was a song that the bass player had written with the lead singer. And it was very, very slow. It was like, doom, 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 doom. And it was very whiny. And I was like, I don't like this. And then Joey and the bass player were like, hey, what about this? And it was like, oh, this is actually fun. And it's also the closest we got to actually playing a ska song. And I learned how to growl with the saxophone, so I do that incessantly in this.
Let's hear it.
Here we go.
Looks like it's stretched to its limit a little bit.
was really solid. I don't think that was anything to be embarrassed about.
That song I actually was very proud of. Everybody contributed to it. It's definitely the most solid song.
Yeah.
Everybody sounds as good as they actually were.
I figured out what it is. That song sounds like three different bands are playing the same song. That's what it is. I'm sitting here. I'm like, it's not bad, but the lyricist, she wants to be in like an emo-y kind of band. Yeah. The drummer and the guitarist wants to be kind of like the Clash. And then you and the bass player are just like, real big fish. Let's do this. But they all just came together. Yeah, and it's it's this weird pie.
That's a problem I've had with every band I've ever been in, where we all have such varying tastes. That song is the one where it actually was like, oh, this actually works. Even though everybody has something totally different going on, but it worked. Yeah. Teenage Calamity is just a mess because I don't need to be there.
No.
Everyone's in a different band.
Everyone's in a different band playing the same song.
But I mean, like, Becca's drumming, I'm just like, oh, this is the one where I'm like, oh, she's such a good drummer. Joey's guitar solo is like so good on this.
But then,
the bass is solid.
But it's like there's one
her singing sounds so much better on this.
It does sound much better. But the thing again is you hear the guitar playing and then you hear the saxophone. And they're playing the same song together, but at the same time, I'm like, oh, they don't know that they're on different stages. The lyrics were better in this.
Yeah. Still, I also realized at the end,
very teenage girly.
Yeah, in the sax solo towards the end, where it just turns into ba-dum-ba-dum, I realized my favorite thing to do with the saxophone when it was just to quote random other songs. So that was just me playing stroking the Billy Squire song. It's in plays at the end of Billy Madison as well.
Oh, okay, now I know it.
Stroke. It's called The Stroke. There was another song we did where I didn't know what key it was in because neither did she. Uh-huh. And the five notes that we knew were in the song happen to be the same notes that you can use to play Moving Right Along from the Muppet movie.
Love it.
So at the end, so at the end of the song, I would just play the dun 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 dun, and nobody knew it was from the Muppets except for me. So I just pretended that I wrote it, and we played it at Battle of the Bands, and only one other person was like, "That's from the Muppets." And I was like, "Yeah, nobody called me on it."
That was
a good song.
I'm surprised you guys did not win first place just based on that song.
There were some really talented people there.
Yeah, but you guys held your own, and I can only imagine what the rest of the band members would probably think of hearing this now.
Oh, yeah.
But they will.
R.I.P.
Yeah. No, I'm going to tag them in this when it comes out. I'm going to post it and promote it and... Let's get a reunion tour.
In the meantime, let's dig into this song, Patrick. No. What inspirations did you get from this song?
Man, all I wanted to do was stand up. I went to a performing arts high school. All we would do is like theater and plays and musicals. And I was 16 when I did this. And I was doing stand up once a month at the Ha Comedy Club on 48th Street in Times Square. I was obsessed with Tenacious D, Stephen Lynch, and Weird Al. And I figured that I should write comedy songs, but I didn't know how to write music. So I just sang an R&B song without any music whatsoever. On a train, I wrote a song about squirrels. And this is called The Squirrel Song. It's so bad.
Sorry, you sang this on stage at Ha?
No, I did not. Okay. I did sing it on stage at Ha. This is not the recording of that.
This is the basement tape version.
This is the basement tape. I put this on YouTube. I used to do a lot of slideshows on Microsoft Movie Maker.
So on YouTube, you can find this with a bunch of squirrel stock images.
Yes.
But the song is what's most important.
Yeah, there's a bunch of squirrel images. You know, this is so bad. I listened to it. I didn't even get through it. I listened to half of it when I sent it because I don't have much audio of me singing in high school.
Except for this.
Because a lot of it, like the audio I have of singing is my friends and I. And all my other friends were very talented. And then there was this me who was like, hey, everybody, let's do a song. Kevin, I don't want you to hear
Patrick,
this.
Patrick, we wrote a musical together. I know you have no talent. Let's play the song.
It's cold outside, what can I say? Waiting for you, my nuts have been freezing all day. Gonna have my babies, I'm gonna give you rabies. You know it's true, I wanna squirrel you away. I like to scratch, 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 climb up that tree. And all these nuts wanna do is get between you and me. Gonna fluff my tail, girl, I'm gonna make you wail. Gonna make you twitch, you crazy squirrel bitch. I'm gonna squirrel you away. Yo, girl, let me talk down to you for a second. I see you talking to that raccoon and that rat. And you know what they don't have, what I have? Some fine-ass black squirrel dick. Climbing is all fun till I pull out my gun. Don't look away, you know chipmunks are gay. I'm gonna squirrel you away. I'm gonna squirrel you away. I'm gonna squirrel you away. I'm gonna away, cause you know them chipmunks is gay. I'm gonna squirrel you away. You wouldn't have a chance with them anyway, cause they're gay and they're squirrels. 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 Squirrels.
Oh my goodness, goodness, goodness. The best part
so
is
so weirdly homophobic.
And you know what's really interesting too is that the video.
Is how gay I am? Yeah.
The video it cuts off the last letter on the screen. Written and directed by Patrick Ryle.
Oh, you turned off the margin thing. Yeah, I did that once.
Yep.
I remember early 2000s iMovie.
Modest Beginnings.
Oh, yeah. A little racist, a little misogynistic.
Very misogynistic.
Very poor wordplay at the end. Why did he have to have a big black squirrel dick? You really set it up with the nuts joke.
No,
you really could have.
It wasn't. Yeah, I don't know.
A few notes.
Weirdly homophobic. I don't know why.
Yeah, what do you got against chipmunks?
At 16, just like, huh, these fucking gays. Little did Patrick know that it was going to be all weird in about a couple months, and you'd be like, fine after that. Man, it was so weird. That was terrible.
I understand why you want to write a thing, but why share this with anybody?
I thought it was funny.
Okay.
I thought it was
funny.
And
now, why did you think that?
Because
it is funny, but not for the reason 16-year-old you thought.
That has like 2,000 views.
What year did you post this?
2008.
Oh, okay. Yep. Yep.
Yeah, so it's
golden age.
How many views does that have on YouTube?
Almost 3,000 views, 5 likes, and 5 dislikes.
Oh, 5 dislikes? That makes sense. 5 likes? Who are you? man, it's so weird. There's one comment, and she's like, this is the best. And I'm like, how dare you? how dare you encourage this? I used to do a ton of videos, because my friends and I, even during class, we would just make sketches and stuff. And there's like so many videos on my old YouTube of sketches in high school that friends and I would film. And those weren't terrible. Like, it's a bunch of kids in high school. Yeah. But even for, like, kids in high school sketch, it was still pretty good. A lot of it was Kids in the Hall and, like, Mystery Show stuff. But it's all watchable and, like, laughable. This is the only thing I'm truly embarrassed by that is still out there.
Well, I'm glad that we were able to find a medium of which to play it for our listenership.
I'm glad I got to hear that. Anytime you have like a note for the cast about just like, hey, try to sing it this way. Hey, I want to play you guys a song called Squirrel. What's the name of that squirrel?
The Squirrel Song?
Great, the Squirrel Song.
Great title.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
coming from a guy who wrote a song called the Act One Finale Song because he couldn't think of a better title.
The July 24th show of...
July 24th, July 28th, and July 30th.
Yep. And what else do you have coming up before then? Any other shows to plug? You guys perform quite often.
Yeah. I co-host a show at QED in Astoria called Press Conference. It's a comedy show where at the end of each comedian's set, they open it up to questions from the audience, like a Sean Spicer type press conference, but they're not hiding in the bushes. And it's a lot of fun. The audience can just shout out any question they want, and the comedian will answer it as earnestly or not as they want. And it's so much fun.
I do at QED also. I do every first Wednesday of the month. I do Dunces and Dragons.
Oh, yes. Sam had talked about that the last time.
Basically, it's just a challenge-based comedy show where comedians have to go on a quest with the audience. I also do Pants on Fire at Brandon Saloon last Sunday of the month. It's a trivia game show with comedians. And I have a new book coming out at the end of the month, which will be available at Carmine Street Comics during Pride, called The Narcissist Travels.
Excellent.
Oh, and we're both in Clip Show, the sketch comedy group.
Every second Saturday of the month, The Creek in the Cave.
7 p.m. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be at Cinderblock Comedy Festival. So will Dunces and Dragons, too. And maybe my dog. Probably my dog.
Maybe. Hopefully. I mean, it doesn't hurt to have a little canine companionship. Patrick J. Riley and Kevin Frolix here on Lost and Rewound. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
We'll be back in a little bit to wrap up here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Did you like today's show? If you did, please donate to Radio Free Brooklyn. It's really very easy. You want to go and support with either your love of Lost and Rewound or your love for all the content that Radio Free Brooklyn has to offer. There are two options. Your first option is you go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/pledge. Our Patreon page is there, and you could donate $1, $5, $10, or an Alexander Hamilton is what I used to call it, because I'm lame. And you have many different choices of donation level, and for each donation level, you get a perk, a gift, because you deserve that. We're a nonprofit organization now, so whatever your donation you provide to us will be a charitable contribution. Keep us going, striving into this new season, season 5. And Lost and Rewound, he's here for our third season. And if you want to be a sponsor for the show, you would want to go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/LAR. We can certainly use your personal financial touch to help make this show even better. Thank you again for joining us on this edition of Lost and Rewound, and we will be back next week with a hopefully recuperated Jimmy Hoffman. Take care.